Stage number 12031.
Peggy Widgery, Reel 3.
One of our very young men at that time, he looked so young because he had blonde hair and blue eyes and he seemed awfully young, and he became engaged. His name was Dick Malaby, and he became engaged to a fanny called Chris Marks, and they were a delightful pair. Now, he parachuted in. He was bilingual. He spoke Italian as a native. And it was arranged that he should land in Lake Como on his first drop. And he was involved with quite a lot of the diplomacy that went on when the Italians were arranging to capitulate. And they especially asked for him. He was captured at one stage, but because he could talk to them so happily and so well, he was asked to be the translator for them when the negotiations were going on. And he was, I think he won an MC and all kinds of decorations. He did remarkably well. And there were many others. It's difficult to remember individuals now. It seems such a long time ago. But they were certainly very brave people. Now, most of the time they went in army uniform, so that although it made them very conspicuous and they had to keep a very low key while they were organizing their groups of partisans who would in turn blow up troop trains and blow up bridges, feed back information so that we in turn fed it to London and they knew what was going on in troop movements and that type of thing. It was important that, of course, all that should be done very accurately. And those who were training the partisans did go in uniform, because if they were captured, then at least they were treated as prisoners of war and not as spies, because otherwise I think many of them did have a very tough time in any case. But it would have been much quicker for them had they been caught in civilian clothes. Apart from the Poles, and then we did have a Yugoslavs section, and we parachuted in there. Winston Churchill's son, Randolph Churchill, did pass through very fleetingly. I didn't have any contact with him, but he did pass through our hands. Malcolm Munter, who had lived in Italy and wrote that famous book, The Story of San Michele. It was a remarkable book. I remember reading it. And his son had joined SOE, together with our general, General Gubbins' son. The two younger men were friendly. And they went out on a recce in a jeep. And they had done this just before I arrived. And regrettably, they drove over a landmine and they were both killed. And it was quite horrifying for everyone, because they were so close to all the people working there. And someone had to undertake the trip. They went in by sea to the island where Malcolm Munter lived in Italy, which was behind enemy lines, to let him know about his son, which was a very hard thing for anyone to do. Now, when our British liaison officers, they were referred to as BLOs, BLOs. When they went in behind enemy lines, sometimes they were taken in by sea. Mostly they were dropped by parachute. And we had Lysander aircraft where they could land quite easily and let them out and pick them up sometimes. They were collected and brought back. Especially if things were getting a bit hot for them, we'd and retrieve them. I don't think I have any more that I can remember clearly on that.
But I imagine you had to be very efficient at your own job.
Yes, I had to work very hard, yes, and it had to be right. And there was no let up. If you weren't feeling too bright, you just jolly well got to get on with it, chiefly because the man I worked for, who was a very clever man, a very hard worker, and he just worked all the hours there were. And he was always there before I got there in the morning, and I was never late, and there way after at night time. He later went back to Oxford, where he'd been a student, and I think he became a bursar there. He'd got a degree in history and one or two other things. Then he joined the Medical Association, the Royal Society of Medicine, who have their headquarters in Wimpole Street, and he masterminded the whole of the rebuilding of a really magnificent building that they have now. It's a beautiful place. And he got all the funding in for it. He sold off plots of land and got more in return, and he did a wonderful job. And he only retired quite recently, and he's still a very good friend of ours. He lives in Oxford. And he's the man I worked for initially.
Because of the need for secrecy, you know, even after the war had ended, yes. Do you think that worked against SOE getting the recognition it deserved?
Well, I think it has to. You hear now about the SAS who were working behind the lines in this recent war in Kuwait and the work that they did. We heard some of the things they were doing there secretly. I did hear recently that some of them were to be given a decoration, but whether they'll be identified because of their own safety. And I do think that it had to be that way, but no, I don't think there was anything like the recognition of the quite remarkable work that was done and the inventiveness of the people in the things that they did and they had to do to make things out of nothing. And It really was remarkable, and it's only looking back on it later. And even recently I heard from Dick Hewitt of some things that had been going on that at the time I didn't even know about at all. And I think it's sad in a way, but it's one of those things that I think for everyone's protection had to be. Of course, I think quite a number of books have been written on SOE since the war, which have been interesting. Different people's aspect of what was going on. And of course they were operating in Algiers. We were working into France mainly. In Italy we were working into Yugoslavia, Italy, a small German section, and Poland. So that it was pretty widespread. And then of course there was another group out in Kandy working into Ceylon.
So after what was it called? Monopoly.
Yes.
Monopoly. You went to Siena.
Oh, we did, yes.
Why was that? Why did you move to Siena?
I think to be nearer all the operations that were going on, probably more airfields. I didn't really know at the time why we were moving, except that we were usually fairly close behind the British lines, and of course, when we were first in Monopoly, the war was pretty close to us there in the south. Then they went through all that very heavy bombing further up Salerno and that area. And then we were moving up. And, of course, Alexander had his headquarters in Naples. I remember visiting there, and it was just beautiful. It was a palace with a magnificent staircase. And afternoon tea was served in the hall every afternoon. I remember being taken in there. And it was just magnificent. It was beautiful. And then there was a long avenue leading up to the palace. I don't know who it had originally belonged to or whether it was a public building, but it was truly palatial. And a long avenue leading up. And when General Alexander, or was he Field Marshal at that time, I'm not sure, but when he was due to arrive, the generals all lived in beautifully fitted up caravans in the grounds, and all the officers. And when it was time for him to drive, the avenue had people stopped and made way, and everything was clear for him. I remember standing there, and he drove up in an open car, and he sat bolt upright, looking very impressive, fine-looking man, exactly as you feel a general should look. He would drive up to his office there. And then, of course, when we got to Siena, I don't know who arranged the accommodation, but in some miraculous way, the Fanners acquired, it was a palace, but it was quite a small, family-owned palazzo. And it was very beautiful. And we were just thrilled after our camp beds. It was beautifully furnished. And I remember I shared a room with a South African girl, and we had plenty of space, and it was all so nice. And excellent food. Whether we kept the chefs, I don't remember, but I know we sat eating beautifully in a lovely dining room. And we made a mistake and gave a party to which we invited the senior officers of the menfolk, and I think the general was visiting at the time, and he was invited too. And the next we heard was that they thought it would make a very suitable place either for the general or for the senior officers, and we had to move out. So we were very sorry about that. However, we moved to a hotel from which we had to be driven each morning in a sort of minibus thing. And it was really Saskatchewan-Sierre, it was called, such a strange name. But it was quite a nice hotel, probably a 3-star, but it was quite spacious and it had beautiful grounds and an outside dance floor and lovely roses growing, I remember. And it wasn't as beautifully furnished, but nevertheless, we were quite happy there, and we had our drive into our office each morning, so that was all right. And, of course, it was from there that I finally came home to England.
Was your work similar?
Oh, yes. I was working with the same man, and it was just the same sort of work. And there was a certain amount of tidying up to do then. We were getting towards the end of the war, and we sensed that it was coming to the end. And so it eased off a little, but there were other things to take its place. We were still busy all the time.
What was it like being in Siena at the end of war? You know, was the town affected very much, would you say?
I don't remember the local people coming out and making a commotion, but I can't help thinking they must have done. I remember we were celebrating in the mess. And whether it was rather like going into Trafalgar Square had we gone to that beautiful Palio area where they hold the horse race each year, it's more than likely that the Italians would certainly have been celebrating, but I wasn't there, and I can't say about that. But it was a very beautiful place to be in. I just loved walking through the streets and just the feel of the place. It was lovely.
Was there any destruction? You know, the fact
no,
that it had been...
not in there at all. No. When I visited Florence on leave, there were plenty of bullet marks on the buildings where there'd been battles going on there. But I don't remember seeing anything of that nature in Siena, and I don't even remember if there was real firing and fighting going on there.
How about the Italian people? Were you able to meet them socially, you know, apart from these few odd characters?
Yes, not a lot, because it was discouraged, you see. They were so afraid that we might say the wrong thing, and they really didn't like us mixing with the local people. But those we had any contact with at all, I loved. I loved the whole atmosphere of Italy. They were so outgoing and so joyous and warm-hearted. I had a great feeling of oneness with them when I could be with them at all. But it was mostly through the staff we had working in the place who would come in and clean and do some cooking and that sort of thing. Occasionally at a party you'd meet people who were associated with the embassy. That was acceptable. But there weren't too many of those. I remember going to a beautiful party in Rome at the embassy, and everyone was in evening dress, and I had borrowed one from a girl who had one out there with her and felt terribly glamorous. It was a floaty grey chiffon, I remember. But we didn't have the opportunity to meet very many socially, unfortunately. I think had I been older and more perhaps independent, I would have made a point of meeting them, even if it didn't meet with approval. You know, I would have somehow, because it seemed so strange not to. But at the time, I usually obeyed the rules, except for the Casbah. After that, I came home when I was, I think I was 20, just at the time I travelled home, and we came into Tilbury. And I wasn't demobilised then, but asked to go and work in London for the Fanny commanding officer. and I worked as her secretary for a time.
Who was she? What was her name?
Her name was Cope. Yes, her name was Cope. And mine was Cope. And we had a girl called Coop working along at the same time that I was in Italy. A family name of ours was Harvey, so during that time I called myself Harvey Cope, simply to differentiate. So when I came home I was still called Harvey Cope, but her name was Cope, and everyone thought we were related, but we weren't. And she was really just trying, she was acting like an agency, really, trying to place people who were on her hands. We weren't due to be demobilised, and I don't know why, but we needed something to do. So I was working for her in this capacity, and I thought it would be nice to go abroad again. And they were looking for someone to go and work in Belgium. And I kept putting my... It was to work for a group of... There were just two, a captain and a lieutenant, who were running a prison camp. They were simply out there with a sergeant and a few corporals looking after a group of prisoners. And they were interrogating them before releasing them to go to their own homes in Germany. And they were trying to find out as much as they could about the political situation and all this sort of thing. And they needed a secretary out there. They needed two. And she said to me, "You're too young to go abroad. You can't go until you're 21. And I said, "Well, I've been abroad for 2 years." And she was shocked that I had been. So, anyway, I kept... Every time I had to get a group of files out for these people who came over to interview for secretaries, I kept getting my own up and putting it at the bottom and infiltrating it, you see. And it kept getting sent back, and I had to put it in the file because she said no each time. And then finally, I think they'd sifted through a whole lot, and they were probably getting desperate, and they hadn't found... I don't know what they were really looking for, but finally it was agreed I should be allowed to go. So with one other girl, we set off, and we went, and we were stationed. The camp was associated with a chateau where the men lived and so on, and so... It wasn't considered correct that we girls should have to live with men. And so we were taken into the village, which was nearby, to the local doctor's house, where we were put up as paying guests, this other girl and myself. Neither of us could drive at that time. So the men felt... We had very pleasant evenings. We all had dinner together, and then I was introduced to a lot of the classical musicians that I hadn't come into contact with before, and we listened to classical music each evening after dinner. And the men really didn't want to have to be bothered to turn out and drive us home each night. And so it was decided that we should learn how to drive. So we were taken out on a very flat, simple road and sort of pointed in the right direction and told more or less what to do with an army pickup, little sort of something like a Morris 8. And so we had to take it in turns to drive each other home each evening. And fortunately, it was a very simple road because neither of us really too clear on how to change gear or what to do. We just got it going and kept going, yes! And then found a way that we could turn round without backing to come back the next morning. And so that was the sum total of our driving. Now, this must have been the dower house of a really magnificent chateau nearby with all the turrets, and it was like a fairy castle. And I remember being invited there for tea. I don't know what her title would have been, but a woman of... perhaps in her 40s. She never seemed to be in a car, but she was always on horseback riding side saddle and always beautifully turned out with all the right equipment. And she'd come and look down at us and say, "How are we getting on?" And she invited us to go and have tea one day, and we went there. And it was, I suppose, a rather typical French or Belgian family where they had the family home and they all lived there, from granny to the parents of some more teenage children and so on, and they all lived in this magnificent place. And it was quite an event being invited there for tea. And then occasionally we'd be taken by the men into Brussels, which we liked very much. We didn't work over hard there at all. We'd just have some typing to do, and they'd interrogated the prisoners of war.
Did you ever see them yourself, the
prisoners? Oh, yes, they were all around. Yes, there was barbed wire around. But, of course, they all knew they were going home, and they weren't trying to escape. They knew they were going to be properly transported or given passes on the train and so on, and that they were just being held for a month or so that they could give all that they knew of what had been going on during the war in the area that they'd been stationed. And this sort of thing.
And would most of them cooperate with that?
As far as I knew, they did. I was never told that they'd been at all troublesome.
And they were treated well, were they?
Oh, I think so, yes. I think they were very much sort of treated as part of the family, really, although they had the barbed wire round and they had to stay in their compound. I don't think they were unhappy. They didn't give that impression.
How about your attitude towards the Germans, you know, having been through the war? How did you feel towards them?
In those days, it all seemed terribly black and white. They were the enemy and they had to be beaten, but I don't think I felt any hatred towards them or anything like that. I know I felt terribly upset about the beautiful houses that were bombed and the people who were harmed in England. When I came across it soon after it had happened, that really did bother me very deeply. But again, I seem to think it was simply, this was war, we were doing it to them and they were doing it to us. I didn't really pin it so much on the Germans, except that we were all in it and we got to beat them. And I was never in the slightest doubt as to whether we would. I felt we were right and they were wrong and we'd got to win. There were no ifs or buts. Now, of course, people do. They weigh up the pros and cons and more. Maybe they did then. I expect more adult people were weighing it up then. And indeed, I know that there were many people who were very pro-German and were related to Germans and regretted deeply that we were at war with them. And I think would have liked to have supported them. We had Molesley, who I think had very strong leanings that way, the American ambassador at that time, Kennedy, quite a few people in quite powerful positions would have preferred not to fight them. But it seemed inevitable. I don't think we could have just sat here and let them take over. I'm sure they would have been as regretful as anyone if that had happened.
I wonder if your mind went back to this. You know, during the Gulf War and the crisis leading up to that, did you relate it in any way?
Not particularly. You see, during all the negotiations where people were trying to avoid the war, Chamberlain and people like that, I was just a schoolgirl interested in hockey and the things that were going on, and that really passed me by. I was aware of the names being mentioned by my parents and news on the wireless and that kind of thing, but I didn't really take a deep interest in it. I lived in a little world of my own, I suppose.
How about the bombings, you know, during the war, when we saw pictures of the bombing? I wonder if that brought it back to you.
No, they really seemed to me to be two totally different things. I felt much more deeply, I think, this time, perhaps than I did when I was so much younger, about the very idea of bombing the way we did. It seemed to have been the right thing to stop the war and stop any more of our people being killed, and it was quite wonderful that so few were. But I couldn't help thinking of the families and the people who were being bombed so dreadfully in that war. They were just young people, many of them not knowing what it was all about. I felt once the word go came, you know, there was all the build-up where we were giving them more time and more time, and would they just stop in their tracks and do something about it, and they just didn't. And when finally it was decided, right, war was beginning, I had an awful sinking feeling about it. I did feel it very sadly then. I don't really know if an awful lot has been achieved, even now, the way the country is going. But faced with those particular circumstances at that time, I don't think that the people who took the decision really had any alternative.
Of course, you were to go to Germany, weren't you, and see the aftermath of war
Yes.
in Hamburg, which must
Hamburg
have been
incredible. Miles and miles of totally flattened area at Hamburg. I was stationed in a beautiful house that had been owned by one of the directors of Persil, the German part of the Persil washing powder. And it was a sort of mock Tudor affair that had a wonderful main lounge come hallway that went right up to the roof, and then there were galleries going round with all the bedrooms leading off, and they had an electric organ that played on those funny roll things that we used to play with, and a huge open fire that burned logs, and that was all very comfortable. And yes, I worked there for a few months, I think, but whenever I went out, I used to like to get out of the place if I could in the afternoons when I wasn't working, and I'd walk perhaps only to the post office or something, and I didn't quite know where to go not to feel depressed, because this particular area, which was on the banks of the Elbe, called Blankenese, it was it must have been a beautiful suburb, because we had a groundsman working in the garden, and he used to mutter about the capitalists were protected, they didn't have their houses bombed, but all the other people did. And whether that was true or not, I've no idea, but certainly there were a few more of these lovely houses along the banks of the River Elbe that were still standing, but you didn't have to walk very far, and it was utter desolation, and I found that awfully depressing. Then there'd be perhaps just one odd little house still standing, and they'd put a picture of the king and queen in their window. I didn't respect them altogether for that. Whichever side was winning, they were on it. And I wasn't sorry to leave there. I felt that it was a very unhappy place. And I haven't seen, I believe Hamburg is now the most beautiful place, now it's all been rebuilt. And I must go there one day and see what it is like.
What were you doing in Hamburg?
There again, it was a mopping up process where they were interviewing people and finding out more and more of what had been going on and if there were any disruptive elements forming, so that they wanted to build up another group that would be subversive, that sort of thing. And just, I suppose, for the records. It wasn't a very interesting job out there. I knew the man I was working for. He'd been in Italy when we were there then, and he'd been put in charge of this small detachment. And it was pleasant enough. There were two or three of the men there, and I think one other girl and myself. We were all in one house there. We were in the nursery wing, and they were such pretty rooms. They were lovely. And we had a batman who'd come in with a cup of tea each morning. He was a plumber by trade, and he'd come in and he'd say, good morning, miss, a beautiful day. And you'd look out of the window, and sometimes it would be teeming with rain, but he always had bright rosy cheeks and a beaming smile, and to him it was always a beautiful day. I wasn't there for terribly long. I asked to come back to England from there because I felt I wasn't really achieving anything, and they did release me then, and I came back into civilian life after that.
Do you think it was important for you, you know, your time with the Fannies during World War II?
Oh, I do. It gave me a much broader outlook than had I stayed in England throughout that time. I'm very appreciative of the opportunities that I had out there, yes. I think it was very important.
Were you proud to have been part of the Fannies, do you think?
Yes, I was. Yes, I think they were a marvellous outfit, and I hope they continue just in case they're ever needed again. I hope they're not, but I think, well, they have the Fanny Club in London, and I think there would be a nucleus who'd
Do you belong to them still?
I didn't, no. I often felt that I should. It's just that I was neither a country member nor a town member. If I spend a day in town, I haven't all that time to spend calling in at a club, and I don't live far enough out to feel it would be a useful place to stay overnight if I did. Although I know it has been explained to me that really it's as much as anything for like-minded business people to meet up now, and I should have found that quite interesting, I'm sure, as I'm in business with my husband. And I wish I'd made more time to do something like that, really. Perhaps one day I shall.
Do you think there's something special about being a fanny? You know, sometimes one gets a feeling of sort of elitism with...
Well, perhaps it could be. I think we felt that we were simply because we had to stay very much together, like a family stays together, because of the nature of the work we were doing. And I think that gave us a closeness and a feeling that we were separate from the others, rightly or wrongly. I don't know that it's a good thing, but I think we did feel that we were something separate.